Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, helping product managers become product masters. Listen and get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host, and this is where product managers learn to be product masters. Each week, I discuss topics important for product managers and innovators, interviewing incredible guests, and today's guest is a person I've been really eager to talk with. You likely already know him as the inventor of the Business Model Canvas, a one-page business model, and author of the related book, Business Model Generation. He's also the winner of the prestigious Thinkers 50 Strategy Award, winning in 2015, and also is ranked as the 15th most influential business thinker by Thinkers 50. Further, in 2013, he won the inaugural Innovation Luminary Award by the European Union. More recently, he co-authored the book Value Proposition Design, which in a way is the topic of our discussion. However, I don't want to just ask him the same questions that he's been asked 100 times before, questions that you can find answers to in other interviews. Instead, I asked him to discuss the book from the perspective of a product manager, identifying the need for the book, its target market, the value it created for customers as well as for his organization, as well as how they thought about the name and how the name was chosen. So you not only get some insights into what value proposition design is, you also get to see the book as a product and the product management thinking that went into its creation. If you're new to value proposition design, think of it as the third leg of a stool consisting of lean startup and design thinking as the other legs. All three are similar in intent, and each provides valuable tools, arguably with Alex's tools being most valuable to product managers who think like product leaders, or in my words, product masters. You'll find the summary of the discussion and other helpful resources at theeverydayinnovator.com/123. There's a little room echo in the interview, but nothing that's distracting. I so enjoyed this interview, and I hope you do also. Alex, thanks for joining the Everyday Innovators.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Oh, I'm so glad to be talking with you. You've done so much to just help product managers and business leaders in general with what you've done with the Business Canvas. Kind of introduced the world to this notion of canvases. Like all of a sudden, all these other canvases popped up in the world, right? Which was a really unique sort of thing to have happen there. Specifically, I wanted to talk about one of your books, The Value Proposition Design. But I want to do it from the perspective of a product manager having created this book. Could you go through a little bit about just what was the context for this? You know, what was going on at the time and inside your company Strategizer that needed this book to come about?
Yeah, there were a couple of triggers. The first one was that, you know, business model generation was pretty successful and a lot of people started using the business model canvas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we designed the business model canvas to help people think about their business model. What we did realize is that some people were misusing, if you want, or repurposing the business model canvas to sketch out their value proposition. Mm-hmm. And the business model canvas was never designed to help with that particular job to be done, right? The only job to be done was, hey, how can I sketch out my business model?
Right.
So we thought, well, there could be, you know, another tool that would go hand in hand, would be like a plugin with the business model canvas. So we try to figure out what would that other tool be. And we started out with thinking, oh, what if we did a tool on jobs to be done? Huh. And then we ended up with the value proposition canvas because we realized that's actually the missing tool. And the jobs to be done concept was kind of the core or part of that value proposition canvas. So that was the origin of the tool. And I'm a big believer in, you know, business people using several tools together and integrating them rather than trying to say, oh, there's this, you know, Swiss Army knife that does everything.
Right.
You don't want your doctor to perform heart surgery on you with a Swiss Army knife. So why do we think in business we need one conceptual tool that's going to solve everything, right? Metrics, strategy, implementation, doesn't work that way.
Right.
So you need to use several tools. So for us, that second tool, the value proposition canvas, was an important one. It's like zooming in. Business model, the business model is the big picture perspective. You zoom into the value proposition and you get more detail on that. So that was the foundational trigger, I'd say. The other trigger was that we learned so much over the years since we launched Business Model Generation that we had a, you know, huge need to share
right.
and to integrate actually with Steve Blank's and Eric Ries's lean startup concepts, right? And the customer development from Steve Blank, who launched the whole thing. Uh-huh. And I'm a big believer, as I said, not just using other people's tools if they work, but also processes that are established. So in the second book, we integrated the whole customer development and lean startup approach. So building on other people's work and integrating, showing how you can integrate this. And then the third trigger was that we just, you know, launched the Strategizer brand. Uh-huh. So we moved away from Business Model Generation, which was a book, towards now having a company with the name Strategizer. So we thought, well, if we write another book and we put Strategizer on the cover as, you know, the company providing this book, and then we also obviously put Strategizer on the old book, Business Model Generation, that would put Strategizer as a brand on the map. And it really worked because we sold, you know, 100,000s of copies of the second book in addition to then we already had over 1 million of the first book. Uh-huh. So it really put the brand Strategizer on the map, and it allowed us to shift from business models to a more general brand. So those were the three big triggers for us among a lot of other smaller triggers.
Yeah, thanks for laying that out. As you're talking about the different tools, right, using one big tool versus small tools, the image that came into my mind, the first time I visited Japan, it was really a big contrast to me. You know, here in the United States, you're over in Switzerland. I'm not sure what it's like there. I haven't been there yet. But in the U.S., whenever there's a construction site, there's these really big earth movers and bulldozers, right, Caterpillar, typically sometimes John Deere makes this huge construction equipment. And over to Japan, the same construction sites for commercial buildings, there would be like a dozen of these little purple excavators, right? And they're in the U.S. the size of what we might call a bobcat, just one of the little one-person digger things that aren't much, you know, they're like the size of a car. And they just use so many of, you know, different tools instead of these really huge big tools. And that's what I think of when you talk about, you know, let's slice up these problems with smaller tools that fit for the exact problem that we need to get done.
I really like to frame it as, you know, business job to be done. Uh-huh. I need to sketch out the business model for this particular idea or this particular improvement. I need to sketch out the value proposition for my customers. I need to sketch out how I'm going to implement this project. So I think for every important business job to be done that a manager or entrepreneur has, we should have, you know, specific tools, and then we, you know, we pull them out of our toolbox whenever we need them. And I don't think that culture exists as much as it should so far. It does in engineering and IT, and increasingly it's coming to business as well. Like in finance and marketing, we've had those tools and accounting, right? You don't just make up accounting every day.
Right.
So why should we not have some more professional tools in innovation, entrepreneurship, and product management? So I think this is really a growth area where people are starting to use more tools, in particular in strategy, innovation, and product management. Mm-hmm.
So you said one of the key reasons for this was as you did the business model canvas, people were kind of misusing that in the sense of applying it to generate a value proposition also. And you looked at maybe going down the path of jobs to be done. I'm curious about that. Can you just tell us a little bit more about how you saw jobs to be done fitting into answering that problem?
Yeah, well, you know, I was doing a lot of workshops at the time and coaching some teams and senior executives around the world in large established companies. And one of the tools I like to use to get them customer focused was jobs to be done. So, you know, building on Tony Ulrich's work and what Clay Christensen promoted and his team. And I was doing some interaction with Innosight at the time, Clay Christensen's consulting firm, in particular with Mark Johnson. And I thought, well, you know, we have this tool, Business Model Canvas, which works really well. And we knew, because we did some research, we knew why it worked well. Because it was visual, simple, practical, and could be used in a business meeting as a design tool. So I thought, well, jobs to be done is an interesting concept, but nobody's really turned it into a tool yet, right? It stayed, in quotes, at the level of a concept. So we started out there saying, okay, what if we could design a tool for that, building on all of the existing work, as usual, you know, from Tony Ulrich and others, but then going beyond that and saying, how would a tool look like? Because we understood the value of business tools, which for me is different from a concept, which is more theoretical, right? And what we ended up with trying to design a tool for jobs is we ended up with a slightly broader tool around value proposition design. Huh. So the way I like to frame it is the business model canvas helps you make explicit how you create value for your organization. How do you create, deliver, and capture value for your organization? The value proposition canvas helps you make explicit how you create value for your customers. And obviously, to succeed in business, you need both, right?
Right.
Just creating value for your customers and going bankrupt doesn't make a lot of sense. And turns out there are companies that sell stuff and still go bankrupt, right? So they're successful from a sales point of view, but not from a business model point of view. And the other way around, you have business companies with business models where the value proposition expires and they haven't tried to reinvent themselves and they have to come up with new value propositions. So
right.
These are just two tools, but very central ones, obviously, in the equation of how do I create a profitable and scalable business.
Right. And that business value expiring issue just happens because the business environment's constantly changing. You know, Kodak is probably one of the bigger notable examples of their business model having to change, and they did not keep up with the changing times. So we need these tools to reevaluate.
If you allow me to build on that, because I think you're pointing to something very important, that I like to say that business models expire like a yogurt in the fridge. My co-author, and the same for value propositions, right? My co-author, Yves Pinier, likes to say, yeah, that's right. But, you know, the advantage with a yogurt is you have an expiry date. With
right.
a business model, you don't. And I think what we're observing now is that business models and value propositions expire faster than ever before,
mm-hmm.
which means companies now, you know, it's not enough anymore to just create better processes and, you know, cut down the costs and be more lean and do better what you've been doing for very long, because you can't cost cut yourself to the future, right?
Right.
Through cost cutting, you won't create new growth. You'll be leaner, but you won't create new growth. So companies need to figure out how can they systematically create new growth engines, not just, you know, entrepreneurs with new startups, but how can you create that same kind of growth dynamic in companies? So it's really, really important. And that's the challenge that companies are facing.
Mm-hmm. And that is, I want to make sure listeners understand that is the extent of this book also, that it's, we'll get back to this in a moment, but it's not just how do you create a value proposition. This is a design system, a design methodology for getting there.
Yeah.
So putting our product management hat back on, looking at it from that perspective. So you had a product out, you're doing these workshops around the business canvas model, saw that the product wasn't always being used the way that you intended, that there was another opportunity here. And product managers, we run into that all the time. That's what we like to see, right? We like to see, oh, hey, we've created another issue for customers that we can solve for them, right? We've identified that for them. And you mentioned then the value that this created the company a little bit, because we always have to look at both sides, right? Does this make sense for our customers, and does it make sense for us to do it too as an organization?
Sure. Yeah.
And you said it was coincidental with creating the Strategizer brand, an opportunity to capture on that. Other elements of value there that it created for the organization?
Yeah. So maybe just a step back, you know, what was our original vision for Strategizer? And that hasn't actually changed. We always believed we could create kind of the SAP of strategy, or the strategic operating system. So we always wanted to build enterprise software that would help senior leaders manage strategy, manage innovation, and create new growth engines. So we thought, well, we can do it for operations with, you know, Oracle, SAP, et cetera. Why can't we do it for strategy? So it's like strategy support tools, computer-aided design for strategy. So that was the original vision. Goes all the way back to my PhD, mm-hmm. which I did on business models. That was the idea, that we could create that. We started out with an iPad app. That was our first prototype before we called the company Strategizer.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved towards a web app. And that's when the brand Strategizer, kind of something we wanted to make a bit more popular, and we wanted to give it some visibility. So that's why we launched the new book. And ultimately, what we learned over time, you know, how do we get towards that vision? We have three pillars. One is the tools and the concepts and the content. How do we help people, business people, you know, better solve these jobs to be done? How do they create business models, value propositions, et cetera? And you do that with the right tools, the right processes, and we teach it to them with content. That's the first pillar. Like, I like to call it sometimes the Harvard Business Review of the 21st century. More practical, more visual, more applied than Harvard Business Review,
mm-hmm.
but without kind of dumbing down the content. The second pillar is the platform, where I really think you know, you can't do strategy systematically and innovation systematically and testing systematically if you don't have software support, if you don't have tools. It's like computer-aided design helped architects, engineers, and ultimately also software engineers work in a very different way. Uh-huh. You know, think of Frank Gehry, one of the famous architects of our times. It was with computer-aided design that he could come up with amazing new buildings that would have fallen apart if they just had made study models by hand. So I think the same is going to happen in business models and value propositions if we have computer-aided design that helps us come up and test better business models and value propositions. Then we're really onto something, right? It's support to the human creativity. Uh-huh. It enables more creativity by helping us, you know, systematically test, just like we test buildings. That's the second pillar. And the third pillar is the services that we offer, because we did learn, and we kind of learned this the hard way, that this is a market that doesn't exist. Like, people don't use software to design and test strategies and business models in companies. Mm-hmm. So we needed to kind of build a consulting arm that would help them understand the tools and the concepts. And we use their online, you know, learning a lot, and that would show them how to do this in their organization. So typically now, to mention two examples, we have wonderful companies that are using this. The two that I can publicly mention, because they're on our blog, is Gore, WL Gore, that makes Gore-Tex. They're, you know, really doing this and reinventing business units and creating new growth engines. And on the other hand, MasterCard, the credit card company, which spread these tools, the business model canvas and the value proposition canvas, to over 15% of their employees now. Hmm. So they're using this as a shared language. So those are the three pillars of Strategizer. Ultimately, our goal is to help business people do a better job. It's as simple as that.
That all ties in well. There's a lot of foundational thought that went into, you know, not just here's another book that we're going to do, you know, this is the next maybe step in some evolution of our growth. But really, you created in some sense a canvas of this framework of the three pillars to structure the future of the company, and how this then contributes to that as, you know, aiding all those elements, but really being a key part in terms of here's a tool now for people to, you know, get their hands on. And it describes the process that we use, and I'll apply it to your organization and what you need in terms of business models and value propositions. Good. Okay. Thanks for going through that. So next question a product manager might ask is, who is this specifically focused to, right? We look at our ideal customer and our target markets. And you mentioned a couple of companies there in passing too, but how do you frame out that target market perspective for these kinds of tools, these offerings?
So for us, there are, you know, several segments that you know, we create these tools for. Very surprisingly, they have similar jobs to be done, even though they might be seen as different segments. However, we target only a couple of those. So, you know, traditionally, our tools, even our software, was used in particular by entrepreneurs, because they were looking for tools that would help them structure their thinking, often engineers or software people who wanted to come up with new businesses. Then what happened over time, which was our target audience, is large companies started to use this a lot more. You know, there we have several target segments within the large companies: innovation teams, product managers, marketers, etc. Mm-hmm. So we split kind of those segments into two, saying we have the enterprise customers, which is our main focus as a company. So we focus on product managers in large companies beyond 10,000 people. We focus on innovation teams in large companies, again, beyond 10,000 people. Uh-huh. But then we focus increasingly on now senior leaders in large companies, because we're seeing a lot of business units, you know, wanting to reinvent themselves. Business units that can be 500 million, 1 billion or beyond, they say, well, maybe our business model expired. Maybe our business model will expire in 5 years. We need to reinvent ourselves. So those are the three kind of our audiences that we target. And now the one I'm working on mostly is senior leaders, you know, the CEOs, the C-suite of these companies, above even the business units. However, what we don't want to lose is also that connection to what we like to call prosumers, people from the bottom up, entrepreneurs, people in companies who don't even, you know, have the budget really. Right. Sometimes they buy these tools from their own credit card, right? But they're early adopters. So we don't want to lose that audience. So we give a lot away or also have some very affordable products, because I do think a lot of the innovation happens there. So we're covering an interesting spectrum that goes all the way from startups, you know, people who've never done business before, to the CEOs of the biggest companies of the world who get excited about this. So they're using the same kind of tools because the problem is a relatively new one. Mm-hmm. How do I think more in a more systematic way about my business model? How do I invent new business models? Obviously, you'll have different constraints if you're the CEO of a multi-billion dollar company or if you're a bootstrapped startup. But the problem ultimately, you know, there are some that are pretty similar. If I'm creating a growth engine at Nestle, the biggest food company in the world, just around the corner here, it's very similar to the problem of a startup, even though you have different constraints. So the job to be done of a startup entrepreneur and an innovation team in a large company like Nestle is actually pretty similar. I would even argue it's harder for this, for the corporate venture, uh-huh, because they have so many constraints. They're almost like entrepreneurs in chains.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yep.
So we have a lot more to do and to offer to these large companies because we help them understand what would they have to put in place to act more like a startup, right? Uh-huh. And we like to call that business R&D. Companies know how to do tech R&D, but they don't know how to do business R&D yet. So basically, this new market that we're playing in is, I like to call it, business R&D. Now, the question is this a hallucination or is this a vision? I do think we're seeing, because I've tested this with a couple of CEOs, there is a real market in business R&D because it's not just about technology. Think of the Nintendo Wii. That was a crappy technology, but it was a brilliant value proposition with a brilliant business model. So we need to figure out, how can we go beyond technology or enable technology? And it's a big theme for product managers as well.
Right. Yeah, the Nintendo Wii is a good example of, you don't have to be the best, you have to be different in a way that's meaningful, right? That captures value for customers. It was not the best technology, as you alluded to.
It was terrible.
Right. But it captured
But it was a great business model, right? With great value proposition.
Absolutely. Going back to your analogy of, you know, what CAD did for the architecture industry, I like that architecture picture when it comes to organizations. And you said, you know, kind of one of those target segments as you're working with the C-suites now is they're seeing a need to reinvent themselves, right? Reinvent what the organization is about. And in a sense, this is, you know, re-architecting the organization. You know, we've seen organizations have real trouble doing that, you know, in the past. And it really does seem to be something that must be led by the very top. And then they often stall out, right? The efforts don't. They don't get widely spread enough in the organization to make any real difference. And I know you're early into this yet. Have you seen success stories yet? I don't know if this was the case with Gore or MasterCard, but the C-suite really driving this change throughout the organization?
For sure. I think, you know, one of the examples where we were not involved, but that I like to use as a great kind of early indicator that this is going to spread, is Amazon. Hmm. So, you know, you have a CEO at the helm who was the founder, Jeff Bezos, mm-hmm, who understands that the real challenge of great companies today is to be what academics like to call ambidextrous. They're world-class executors on the one hand, but they're world-class innovators on the other hand. Mm-hmm. Every company that started out small, so at the beginning they had to build something. You know, even Nestle or GE was a startup one day, right? Now, the challenge is when you become big, when you create processes to better execute a known and proven business model, you have great processes that you try to make leaner and leaner to, you know, produce the same value proposition with more profit, maybe through new channels, etc. Mm-hmm. The challenge is, how do I, at the same time, knowing that some of these business models and value propositions are going to expire, at the same time, in parallel, how do I create a startup culture?
Right.
And the reason that's so difficult is because the mindset is so different. On the one hand, I like to call it exploit, explore, or improve, invent. When you exploit, you're in an execution mindset, linear processes, you know, you try to be leaner. You cut down the fat, you kill everything that looks different than the business model that succeeded so far. And on the other hand, when we talk about explore, we don't know what's going to work. So we actually have to experiment.
Right.
And in explore, failure is not an option. It's actually mandatory. Because if you don't experiment and learn, you're never going to come up with something new. And that's where Amazon built this dual operating system. Like some people call it the dual operating system. Uh-huh. They're world-class execution. They run warehouses. Amazon Web Services is rarely down. When it is, the internet is almost, you know, standing still. Right. So they're world-class at running that, and their failure is not an option, right? You're not allowed to fail. On the other hand, they're world-class at experimenting. Uh-huh. They try out new things, right? Amazon Web Services was a crazy big bet. They started small. They learned what worked. They built on some of their strengths. They eliminated some of the weaknesses, and they scaled that. And that's why Amazon has so many growth engines. Amazon is the company that grew fastest from $0 to $100 billion in revenues, fastest ever in history, in business history. Well, guess what? It's not a coincidence. And it's not just because of Jeff Bezos. It's because he and his team put in place a system that allows them to systematically innovate. Right. And that's what we're lacking in many companies. When they create new growth engines, it's a lucky punch. It's the right person at the right place. You know, what we really want is a system that allows us to continuously produce home runs over time, new value propositions, new business models that are different from the one that has succeeded so far. So I think we'll see a few more of those, and we'll see a lot more Kodaks and Nokias and Blackberries, because not all companies will be able to adapt. And, right. You know, Steve Blank, my friend, likes to call it the disposable company. Some companies will become big and disappear.
Right.
And, you know, take companies that were hyped by the press like GoPro. Maybe GoPro is a disposable company because they are still big. They're still great. They still make great products. My kids love them. Uh-huh. But they don't have a business model, I think, today that is sustainable. So if they can't reinvent constantly their business model, they might disappear in the next 2-3 years, right? Now, to their credit, they're trying, but they're still very much focused on product. Sorry, I get very excited, so my answer's longer, but I think it's a huge issue that we're seeing many, many companies struggle with. And it's an issue that goes through, you know, from the C-level down to product managers, down to people. Yeah. Reaching customers, it's a big thing. This is a big shift that we're living through, I believe.
It is, and I love the Amazon example that you shared. You know, Amazon, they're another good example of this dual operating system in terms of how much criticism they have received over time from investors because they weren't optimizing their profit generation capability. It's like, why are you wasting money over here on this innovation operating system, right? Yeah. But indeed, that is the thing that has built, you know, their pillars that allowed them to grow so quickly. You know, over just the last few years, we've seen, you know, monumental growth out of them.
Right.
And that's what companies need to be doing, you know, looking towards the future too. You said, you know, being a sustainable organization is one that first must exist in the future, you know, before anything else.
But you're pointing to an extremely important thing there, that the stock market values short-term returns, okay? Which means no company or no CEO really has an interest if, you know, if they're somehow, you know, related to even their bonuses related to stock market performance. They're not incentivized to think long term, to invest long term. So what's very difficult, you know, what we would have to have is the established business model should be valued, evaluated, and kind of judged by the stock market. Uh-huh. But that new part where they're creating new growth engines should not be valued by the stock market. That should have, you know, we should have different capital there. We should have more of a venture capital approach, right?
Yep.
So the paradox is that today the established companies need to create new growth engines because the stock market does value growth over time. However, they don't value investments in the future growth, which is a, you know, big paradox. So we need to find a way that companies can make those investments. And in the case of Amazon, it's just Jeff Bezos pushing back.
Right.
And we're seeing that's one of the reasons why more and more founder CEOs try to keep the ownership and you know, they have more voting rights than everybody else because that gives them the right to invest long term.
Absolutely.
So it's not a surprise that more companies want to stay private. Or more founders try to keep, you know, the voting majority, even if they don't have the most shares. And that's exactly because it allows them to invest into the future.
And this is a really good discussion we're having now for product managers, because more and more senior leadership inside companies are expecting their product managers to contribute more strategically. And product managers, you know, we run our heads up against this problem of wanting to have more of an innovation capability and operating system in the organization. And this is part of the, you know, what goes in that discussion with executives to how to contribute to making that happen.
Yeah, I think that the big issue is that there's sometimes a bit of a disconnect between people on the ground who are running these innovation projects and the top. You know, mm-hmm. we still, and this blows me away, big companies are still asking for business plans for new ideas. Mm-hmm. A business plan when you build a new factory or you open an, you know, your 110th store is fine because we're talking about a known problem. It's an execution problem. Great. You can write a business plan. You can project the future. However, when you're addressing a new market with new customers, maybe a new business model, probably with a new value proposition, how are you going to make projections? Right. You know, it's after a bottle of wine or a bottle of vodka. I mean, it's a dream, right? So then we write a business plan and then senior leadership expects us to execute a fantasy. Well, guess what? You know, Steve Blank likes to say, again, I'm quoting him because he has these great one-liners. Mm-hmm. No business plan survives first contact with customers.
Right.
So what we need is a leadership that understands when it comes to innovation, we're moving fast. We're experimenting. Business plans are actually a way to maximize the risk of wasting money, the risk of failure, rather than to minimize it. Mm-hmm. What we need is a mindset to say, we don't know what's going to happen. We have no clue at the beginning. However, we have a process and a system in place to reduce that uncertainty. The more experience we make, the faster we learn, the more we reduce uncertainty. And it's not by writing a business plan that we're going to reduce uncertainty, right? It's about iterating and pivoting these business model canvases, value proposition canvases by talking to hundreds of customers.
Right.
That's how we reduce the risk of failure. And I think product managers understand this process really well. The problem is it's sometimes a disconnect with the senior leadership, but it's changing, right? It's changed. That's the good news.
That's the good news. And your work is helping that considerably. As you said, you're in some sense having to build the market as you go.
Yeah.
Because businesses are starting to recognize more this notion of, you know, business strategy R&D, you know, business model R&D. So
exactly.
That's good. Let's talk about name a little bit. So for product managers, we get involved with having a name product some of the time, depending on our role, where we're in marketing or the like. And a name has a big impact on our product. It's easy to Google, you know, product name failures and find out the bad ones. And in my case, I told you when we were chatting a little bit earlier, you know, your book, when I first saw it come out, I didn't look at it closely, right? And that was because it's like, oh, value proposition design. I put the emphasis on value proposition, like, I know how to write a value proposition. Okay, sure. Do I have more to learn? Absolutely, right? But I didn't go any further. And it was only several months later that our friend said, no, you really need to look at this book because the emphasis is really on design for my take on reading it, right? As you said before, you were able to connect into things that were going on at the time with, you know, the lean startup and design thinking sort of things. Talk about the name and what you guys did in coming up with the name and what you considered and what you think about that.
Yeah, so a couple of things. First thing is we did test the name. So we had a group of 100, what we call pre-readers in this case, that we selected, and they helped us work on some of the book content. And they helped us craft some initial titles. And then we took three of those initial titles crafted by these people and us, and started to test them, you know, on our website with 10,000s of hits and see which one performed best. So we had things like customer stampede, value proposition toolbox, and, you know, all these things. And value proposition design won. But here's the catch. And it's something that I think is a big lesson also for innovation and product management. When your starting point is wrong, you know, you'll have a local maximum. So
right.
What I realized later on is that a couple of things were not very good with the choice even of value proposition. It's a bit of a fancy term, and we like to avoid jargon, and maybe we should have, and we had something at the beginning, like, you know, make stuff that people want, whatever. But value proposition is a bit too fancy. It's maybe product would have been better. That's the first thing, that we used some terminology kind of learned that later on, but it's very hard to test. You know, is this the right terminology or not? So it's something we didn't catch with testing. That's the first thing. But the second thing, it's very interesting that you shared your experience, is while we thought that the audience for value proposition design for the book and the tool was broader, like there are more marketers, there are more product managers, there are more salespeople that have to sell, make, you know, value propositions than people who focus on the business model. We said, well, it's clearly a broader market. What we learned over time, and this is a thing that you learn over long term, very hard to test short term, is that a lot of people reacted like yourself, saying, I know what a value proposition is. I know how to do this, which is very different from the topic of business models. There were more people who were willing to accept they didn't know how to really think about a business model. So there were more people searching for the term business model than people searching for the term value proposition. It's only, and this we learned this over time, when people start to play with these tools, they start to see their limitations in how they worked so far. So there is, you know, I think it is a breakthrough in using these tools to have better conversations and better processes. However, people do not see, you know, a burning pain. And that's what I like to call, you know, in the jobs to be done. When the job is not tangible enough or painful enough, then guess what? People are not going to pick up on a new solution.
Right.
And so the job of figuring out the business model and the pain of not knowing how to do it was bigger for business models than for value propositions. So that means for us that it took a lot more educational work, a lot more convincing to do, to tell people, look, you know how to do a value proposition, but you can do it 10 times better. So we had to, and this was a big learning for me as an entrepreneur. We had to explain a lot more. We had to educate a lot more because there was not this pull, right? We had to push a bit more. We knew we had a valid solution, but we needed to push and make it experiential and get people attracted. Whereas with business models, they came to us. We didn't have to do anything. Like people, you know, hundred thousands literally were searching for the term business model and how do I figure that out? Which is not the case for value propositions, though the target audience market is bigger. Now, the good news is the total addressable market is bigger. So it's now up to us to convince people there's something here. But it was harder, a lot harder for value proposition design for business model generation for reasons we didn't catch in the testing phase because we did test a lot. I think it's a great lesson for product managers understanding, okay, where is there a stronger kind of pull already? You want to focus on that. Wherever you have to push more, even though you have a clear vision, you might take a longer term approach. So typically, you know, we know that we're onto something, but we also know it will take 10 to 20 years until the market is ready. So we have intermediary value propositions, intermediary business models to get to our bigger picture vision of where the world will be in 10 to 20 years. Big learning.
Yeah. And I can see how the puzzle pieces fit together at the time too. That I appreciate business model, you know, that had more pain associated around it. You know, anyone that's done a 30-page business model, you know, just really never wants to do that again. And the idea of a one-page canvas that is a great collaboration tool that you can immediately start using, I can generate in 20 minutes. You know, this is really compelling, right? Compared to value proposition, which was a hole that you found as you were interacting with customers on the business model tools, like, oh, you know, this is something we do need to provide a solution for the people using it now. So I can see how those pieces fit together really well. And you did the testing, right? And, you know, product managers, we like to have some data to rely on and say, yeah, this is a reasonable choice, right?
But here's the paradox. I mean, there's a study by Simon Kucher, the biggest pricing firm in the world, that shows that 72% of all new products and services launched don't deliver on their promises. 72%. I mean, 7 out of 10 products fail.
Right.
So apparently the pain is big,
right?
You would think. But, you know, the reality shows that whatever the stats tell you, the reality is a bit more difficult. So because in large companies, you know, we have these failures and people don't necessarily get, you know, it's like they're able to brush this under the carpet. It's not as big as a pain as the statistics might show you.
Right.
So it's really interesting what you learn in the process. And as a product manager, as an entrepreneur, as an innovator, these are the things that I think tools will help us learn a lot better. And we're in the business of making tools. I like to call ourselves toolsmiths. You know, the pains that we're facing, we're making the tools for it. And we just hope to promote more of these tools and give them away and some sell some parts of it so we can change the way people do business. So we can inverse that stat. It shouldn't be that 7 out of 10 products fail.
Right.
It shouldn't be, right?
Right.
So I think we're on a good path as a community of thinkers and doers to do better.
Yeah, absolutely. So this book, Value Proposition Design, and we probably don't have time to do this question justice. I just want to make sure I frame this properly for everyday innovators that are listening. So when I went through it, I went, oh, so this helps me to connect some pieces from lean startup practices, helps me to connect some pieces from design thinking, building from that kind of place of what I knew before of the business model canvas, right? And like your previous book, I'll say entertaining, right? It's an entertaining book to grasp in the sense that just how it's laid out, it's very visual and it conveys information well. And putting it kind of in that circle, am I framing it in a way that is reasonable here? You know, so value proposition design, lean startup, and design thinking, you know, they're kind of in a circle that helps us. How do we solve a customer's problem and get a product in their hands that produces value for them?
What I would add to that is the visual thinking part. So something we always believed in with Yves Pinheiro, my co-author, but we kind of underestimated the value is making things tangible and visual. Mm-hmm. Like when you say product, you say, okay, I'm going to make a prototype. But when you say business model and value proposition, you know, how can you make that tangible? Well, it turns out with a canvas, you can, right?
Right.
So in addition to the design thinking, to the lean startup, and the tool aspect, simply the visual aspect was very important.
Yep.
Here's the funny thing, and I learned to deal with it a lot more, is that, you know, on Amazon, I sometimes looked at the reviews, in particular for the first book, and people would say, yeah, this is just, you know, the same stuff. Like, we already know this. There's nothing new here.
Hmm.
Well, it turns out that when you have literally millions of people using a tool, probably there's something there. Now, I think we didn't reinvent the wheel, but we made things a lot more practical and systematic.
Yep.
So we were not the first to talk about business models. We were not the first to talk about value propositions. And, you know, we didn't invent lean startup or customer development. But I think what we're pretty good at, and when I say we, I really mean the strategizer team, you know, around content, but also software, is we try to take these things and make them ultra relevant and ultra practical. So I think when it comes to business books, there's a lot of good stuff out there. But ask any audience, are business books too long, too theoretical, you know, not practical enough? Do you need to translate them? Do they lack visuals? People will always, you know, you can prove in a minute that the format is broken. So I think what we're trying to really focus on when it comes to the content part is how do we help make that translation from a concept, from an idea, a business idea, you know, business tool, into something ultra practical that a manager, product manager, senior leader can use in a meeting in their daily work.
Yep.
That part, I think as a community of business thinkers, we're not good enough yet. And that's what I hope. And you said, you know, more and more canvases are popping up. While sometimes I'm annoyed that some of these canvases are really bad,
right?
I am happy to see that there's a trend there. And I do hope there will be more business, you know, kind of business tool creators out there, more business tool smiths. I guess we have to share a bit more, you know, how to make good business tools, how to make them practical, relevant, conceptually sound. So the noise goes away and we have more of these tools. I don't think I'm very good at many things, but I am pretty good at business tools. And I hope I can share more of that in the future so we can have more business tools.
Absolutely. I'm flipping through your book here as you're talking about that. One of the early sections is the business reader profile, right, where you address the pains and gains and the jobs that they need to get done. And that's a big one, right? That, you know, we don't have enough time. We need things that are easier to digest. And when I was alluding to this kind of circle of the three, right, before, you know, lean startup and design thinking and this, in no way, I want to make sure listeners know, when I read this book, it's like, oh, you know, there were new light bulbs that went off, right? And a lot of times I get asked questions when we're talking about validation, you know, what are some good customer validation questions, right? And we might go look at Eric Ries's work, or I often look at Ash Mariah's, what he's done in running lean, kind of a follow-up to lean startup things, has some good tools there. You provide awesome tools like that in the book, right? You know, here's great customer questions to help investigate ideas and problems, right? And so I'm starting to recommend tools out of here to people when I get those questions now. So
And I think, you know, we're only at the beginning. So typically right now I'm working on a new online course around these particularly, you know, customer development lean startup tools. Because I do think the ideology is there, people are shifting, but I don't think we have all of the practical answers. Like, how do you define a good hypothesis? How do you design a good experiment? Even how, one thing that we're seeing in a lot of projects, teams are struggling to kind of synthesize their interviews and learn and act upon the data that they generate. It's very easy to do an experiment. It's very easy to do 10, 20, 100, 500 interviews. However, the interview is not relevant if you don't learn and act and make progress. So even, you know, this fancy term that's coming up, innovation accounting, I don't think we're there yet. We don't have a good way to measure progress, you know, not activity, measure progress from idea to business. So that's one of the things that I'm really excited about and I'm working on now. And what we learned is books go so far. With the online courses, we can go a lot further. So we're trying now to say, okay, well, let's not do a book on its own. Let's do a combo where you have a book, but you have an online course also, and you can kind of play with the two. Because what we really learned is this blended learning, physical, you know, kind of things to touch, the online content and exercises that teams do together, that's the best combination. So multi-channel, obviously, you know, one of those things that's been around, we're starting to learn how can we really help teams scale this up. So this is big learnings that came out of projects like MasterCard. How do we go from a small team that knows how to do this to 10, 15, 20, you know, 50% of the company knows how to do this? That's the big challenge. And get them excited, because you can't, nowadays everybody has a lot to do. You can't tell them, oh, you need to do this. No, you need to get them attracted, right? You need to want them to learn. And when you have a busy day, the last thing you want to do is learn more. If you don't see it's relevant, nobody's going to invest in this, right?
Yeah, exactly. I've been doing what I call study groups. I'm rebranding this for a moment, but companies for a while now, and it's built around, you know, that e-course, you know, e-learning, independent learning, and then coming together to discuss how they apply to your situation, your company. And that's been really effective, you know, the making that combination. So I'm going to check out what you guys are doing more too. That's really good. So much more we could talk about in this area. I just want to make sure listeners know I strongly recommend this book. I found it very valuable myself. And to get to the end of the time here, I love innovation quotes. I always ask for one. Do you have an innovation quote you could share with us?
There's so many. I think, you know, what I found really fascinating is Steve Blank's work, simply because for me, it connected the dots. We were talking about design thinking in the first book. Business model generation. Yet we didn't really call it testing the way Steve Blank called it, you know, first in the four steps to the epiphany, and then after in the startup owner's manual, where he integrated our tools. So we mutually integrated each other's tools. So I do think that process of customer development, and you know, obviously also Eric Ries's book, I think that combo is extremely powerful, extremely powerful. Now, I like visual books, so actually, interesting enough, I dive a lot into architecture books and cookbooks to get inspiration for the books we do, because, you know, innovation needs recipes. We need to figure out how to do this, and I think cookbooks and architecture books give us a little bit of that. But otherwise, the combo between the Steve Blank's book, Eric Ries's book, and our books is a good foundation to start from there. I think the stuff that goes further when you're in a large company is, you know, Rita McGrath's books on, okay, how do I create a more transient strategy? So, you know, the end of competitive advantage, I think, is the next step when you move a level up and you think more corporate. So tons of book out there. And obviously, you know, all of the great stuff that you've also portrayed a bit in your interviews with Tony Ulwick. I mean, there's no end to that list. And the way we, you know, we learn in professions like medicine or so, I think we should have that continuous kind of mindset of learning in business innovation and strategy. It doesn't stop, right? And we need to be a lot more professional. I like to say, you know, when innovation and entrepreneurship and product management becomes a lot more like teaching accounting, then we figured it out.
Right.
Because, you know, nobody just goes out and does some accounting, right? There's some rules, there's some processes, and there's a system in place that makes it work mm-hmm. on a large scale throughout the world. And innovation, strategy, entrepreneurship is a young discipline, so we're not there yet. But I do think we can get a little bit more rigorous, mm-hmm. always staying flexible enough to enable the creativity of human beings, right? Of entrepreneurs, of innovators to prosper. However, I think we can be a lot more systematic. So I think that's a big, big thing for me. I'm trying to bring in at least a little bit of that more system in these things that, you know, we have been doing for decades. Innovation is not new. Creating products is not new, but I think we can be more systematic about it.
And when I put together the show notes for these, I always put together the specific, you know, innovation quote. So I'm going to give you an option because I pulled out one from you as you were talking, right? Which is at the end there, which is simply, we can be a lot more systematic, which I like. And also, if you have a favorite Steve Blank quote, we could throw that in there too.
I'll give you two, actually. The one from Steve Lang that I like is, you know, you need to get the out of the building. There are no facts in the building.
Right.
So I think we spend way too much time thinking about our ideas and, you know, fabulating about them. Steve Lang likes to say there's a fine line between vision and hallucination. It's only when you get out of the building that you can test that.
Right.
But the one I think that's, you know, really important, connecting it back to Jeff Bezos also, is that one of the things that he wrote in his 2015 letter to shareholders is he believes that Amazon is the best place in the world to fail.
Hmm.
How many CEOs have you heard say that? You know, I believe my company is the best place in the world to fail. As long as we don't have that mindset, innovation is not going to happen on a large scale in large organizations. So for me, at the moment, that's my favorite quote that I really like to share with senior leaders, with the CEOs that I have the opportunity to talk to sometimes, because the more companies we get to think like that, the more senior leaders we get to understand there's a dual operating culture, the more we can prosper as innovators, not just outside of the systems as entrepreneurs, but inside. So I think we want to have the best of both worlds. We want to see innovation coming out of startups, but also out of large companies, right? We'll have different types of innovation. So I'm excited about that quote very, very much, because I think it shows what CEOs in the world should be thinking about and what they should be proud about.
Right.
And Bezos saying, I'm proud that you can really fail at Amazon. That's amazing, right? Mm-hmm. I'd like to see more CEOs say that.
Yeah, exactly. That's a powerful quote and one I was not aware of. And I always love hearing new quotes too. That paints that dual operating system picture well too. In terms of just wrapping up here, how do listeners find out about the book specifically? Where's the best place to go? And anything else you want to share about Strategizer and what you guys are doing now?
Yeah, we have a lot of free resources on strategizer.com. You can also just Google, you know, Alex Osterwald or Business Model Canvas, and you'll find all of that stuff. I mean, I think our blog is something that is worth following, blog.strategizer.com,
mm-hmm.
simply because we try to share our latest learnings. And we have this visual and short blog post format that allows you to read a blog post in 2 minutes and get something out of it. That's where we share our latest learnings from the field, from our conceptual thinking that we apply in some of the most successful companies around the world. I think that's worth checking out.
Good. So blog.strategizer.com. And for people that want to find Value Proposition Design book itself, is Amazon the best place? Or do you have okay, go to Amazon, look for Value Proposition Design. I will put all the links in the show notes, make it easy for everyday innovators to find those resources too.
And both books, actually, just one more thing, actually, both books, you know, we make 1/3 of the book freely available. So if you go to strategizer.com, you get half, 1/3 of Value Proposition Design and 1/3 of Business Model Generation for free. So, you know, check it out. If you like it, then go to Amazon, right? You don't have to buy the book to figure out if you like it. So we try to bring a little bit of freemium to the world of physical books.
Always being innovative. Alex, I sure appreciate your time. Thanks so much for bringing these ideas, important concepts to our listeners. Thanks again.
Great. It was awesome to be being part of this. Thanks for the questions.
Thanks for listening. Please tell other product managers and innovators about this podcast. I make that easy. Just go to the show notes for the summary of the discussion with Alex, and you'll find the links at the top of the page to share it on your favorite social media sites. Also, from the same page, you can download my Product Mastery Roadmap that shows you how to go from product manager to product master, really becoming a product leader. All that and more is at theeverydayinnovator.com/123. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to The Everyday Innovator, which teaches product managers to become product masters. For more resources, please visit our blog at theeverydayinnovator.com.